Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Negative Space, a novel. By Gillian Linden, narrated by Aaron Felgar. Monday. "Don't be scared," I said. Jane was clinging to her stuffed dragon, looking resolved. "Remember all the candy they give you at the end." The waiting area was empty, and the receptionist brought us right to the examination room. Jane shoved me off and climbed into the chair. The dentist moved briskly, pulling on gloves and scooting forward on a rolling stool. She wore an herbal perfume that cut through the faintly sweet medical smells of the office. There was a bit of glamour about her, which made me see the trappings of dentistry differently. The turquoise blue lounge chair where Jane sat, the strong light shining onto her face, the silver tools. She held up Jane's lip and said, "Do you see this? This? Gum infections." She didn't sound interested.
"Huh?"
Jane said. "Infections?" I said. "More cavities?" "Jane, you're done. You go with Noelle and pick out some treats." When Jane was gone, the dentist said, "Deeper than cavities. Don't worry." She took off the goggles. "If she rinses her mouth with salt water, she won't need the teeth extracted."
"Extracted?"
"I have lots of children rinsing with salt water." She looked up and seemed to be counting them. "Quite a few." We left, Jane holding a plastic bag with a light-up toothbrush and 7 sugar-free lollipops. One for each year of her life. I explained what the dentist had said about the infections, rinsing with salt water. She said,
"I'm not going to do that."
I took her little hand, which moved delicately against my palm, and explained tooth extraction. A strange dentist, a sick feeling from the gas, soreness after.
"Will I cry?"
she asked. I told her she would. That seemed to take care of it. Jane began to sing,
"I wake in the morning and I step outside."
We walked in and out of shade, passing the mother of one of Lewis's classmates. She was wearing a mask and speaking into her phone.
"I wake in the morning."
I had to pick up copies of A Midsummer Night's Dream for the 6th grade, and I wanted to check in with Jeremy, chair of the English department, about my classes for next year. I was part-time, always the last to find out my schedule, but it was nearly June.
"Look,"
Jane said, pointing at a tree with its roots exposed. They spread from the trunk like a messy skirt.
"Poor tree. Your phone wants something."
Was that my phone? There was a reminder on the screen. Olivia S. Something else I had to do. A 9th grader had mentioned suicide in a class discussion about unhappy endings, and the school psychologist had asked me to find out what was behind it. I didn't believe much was behind it, but with suicide, you wanted to be sure. Dorothy, the head of school, liked to imagine teachers as guardians, protectors. "Parents have entrusted their children to you," she would say at the beginning of every year. "They are in your care." We arrived at Jane's school. Jane was singing, "Hey, hey, hey, hey," but stopped abruptly when we reached the steps. She pulled a lightly stained mask over her mouth and nose. I hugged her, and she vanished behind the wooden doors. 2 women were at the corner, and one said, "I don't buy clothes anymore. I have enough to wear until I die." I also, surely, had enough to wear until I died. I had clothes that would outlast me, but I didn't want to dwell on that. I was teaching the metamorphosis, and I had to remember what to say, and especially what not to say to my class. Teaching made me more aware of everything I didn't know, and it showed me the fragility of the things I thought I did know. Rounding. You'd say I knew nothing about anything. I wanted to tell my class Kafka was afraid of his father. Some of them would certainly relate. Kafka had written a letter about it, and I'd spent the night before annotating my copy, picking out bits to read out loud, providing some context. But this morning, I couldn't find it. I checked my folders, the desk, all around the couch, every surface of the apartment. Lewis, who hid my keys and wallet and shoes, said he didn't hide the letter, and Jane said she'd never seen it in her life.
"And if you ask me again," she said, "I'm not going to say goodbye to you at school."
But I blamed her, Lewis, and Nicholas, and most of all, my phone. If I could get more sleep, if I could concentrate, I'd be an organized person. I wouldn't misplace things. And I'd retain information to pass on to my students. Not that they seemed very interested in hearing more from me. The school building came into view, its bricks patched with sunlight. There was a courtyard in the front, and I stopped there to text the children's babysitter. Lewis had a gardening class after his school and would need a later pickup, and I wanted to let Marion know about Jane and the salt water. There were messages on the screen from Nicholas, in his office for the first time in a year. He'd sent a link to an article about the after effects of COVID, which we'd had, a picture of me and Jane in the middle of a snow-covered field, and three requests that I call him, which I did, sitting on the wide steps leading up to the main entrance. The stone was cool against my legs and nearly soft, smoothed by use, like centuries-old linen, which was sturdier and more supple, I'd read, than anything being made today. Nicholas picked up quickly.
"Hello."
"How is it?"
"Depressing. No one's here."
"I thought people had been coming in."
"A few people."
"So what's up?"
"What's up with you?"
"You wanted me to call?"
"I just wanted to say hi. You never respond to texts."
"I didn't hear them."
"Turn the volume up." "Hello?"
"Hello?"
Sorry, that was my work phone. "You're here?"
"I'm still here."
"Not you."
Bits of mica in the path glinted at me, and Daria, the movement instructor, walked into the school in her personal atmosphere of eucalyptus and orange. Her name was similar to mine, and occasionally I received an email intended for her. They were mostly dull, questions about attendance, questions about schedules. But once, last year, I was sent a long message from her husband, a chemistry teacher. Gandhi said forgiveness is a quality of the strong. I waved and half stood to go in with her and remembered Nicholas. "Nikki," I said.
"I spoke to Paul,"
he was saying.
"Oh, I have to go."
"You have to get off the phone with me?"
"One second,"
he said. Not to me, because he hung up. I texted him a middle finger emoji. Marion had given my saltwater text a thumbs up. I put away the phone, feeling discontented. One thing was, I wasn't caring for my children well. I wasn't at ease about the gum infections.
"It's unusual to have two at a time,"
the dentist had said. I wanted to nourish Jane and Lewis. I'd cook tonight. Protein and vegetables. I saw minerals pouring into Jane's cells, saw them sparkling like the mica in the ground. The school lobby had a tiled floor and smelled like cinnamon toast and coffee from the faculty lounge. I'd wondered how many parents made their pleas during admissions and shelled out the tuition, higher than the average American salary, because of the wholesomeness of the smell. I waved to the security guards, all looking at something on a tablet, and went to the elevator. My classes, ninth grade and sixth, met in what was called the rig room, off the gym. Floor mats and balance beams were stored here, and there was a climbing wall. The climbing wall didn't tempt the ninth graders. It was hard to imagine them climbing anything, least of all a wall designed for the purpose. But it did intrigue the sixth graders, especially Jasper. He'd written a poem with the line, "I know the careless mother." So did I. Jasper's mother, Fiona, was dean of seventh grade.
The ninth graders wandered in with studied nonchalance. I logged onto the computer so that my remote students could join on Zoom. "Rosie," I said, "can you hear me?" She gave me a thumbs up. She was sitting outside, and behind her was a plant with dark, reaching branches. It looked like an absence rather than a presence, as though it had been cut out of the fabric of the world. "Daniel, can you hear me?"
"I can hear you."
Everyone in the room covered their ears.
"Not again," Caleb said.
"I can hear you," said Daniel.
You go,
I heard the teacher in the gym next door say. A tall child came into the rig room and said,
"Can you please turn your volume down? We can't hear anything over his voice."
"Can you not hear me?" said Daniel.
"Don't say anything," I said.
"Can you hear me?"
Daniel said. I muted him.
"We're going to switch the sound to my laptop." No one would hear Daniel and Rosie except me. And Daniel and Rosie wouldn't hear anyone unless I brought my laptop right next to each speaker. I checked the tabs on my browser and closed a full-body scan relaxation video. I didn't want the students to consider me in relation to the phrase full body. I turned off the sound on the classroom computer and found Zoom on my laptop. It took time. If this had been the sixth grade, the students would have been telling me their weekend plans, and that the room was stuffy, and that I was assigning too much work, but the work wasn't as challenging as it had been the year before, when they'd had Miss Marsh. Some would have draped themselves over the air filter, blocking it completely. Some would have started up the wall. But this was ninth grade, and the students subsided into watchful silence, broken by soft laughter. I opened Zoom, closed Zoom, restarted my computer twice, and finally I was on, and could hear Daniel and Rosie quietly affirm their presence. It was as though they were whispering into my ear.
"Can you hear me?"
I said.
"Barely," said Daniel.
I held up Kafka's Selected Stories, an edition with a yellow cover, powdery under my fingers.
"Did everyone remember to bring this?"
A couple of students nodded.
"Hold up your books."
Rosie held up her book, and a breeze fluttered the pages. Luca F. put the book on his desk. Several students began to look through their bags. Daniel said,
"One second,"
and his box went black. "Autumn, do you have this book?" Autumn, a girl with a clear, floating voice that reminded me of Lewis's, gave me a look of pure confusion. Her mother was a corporate lawyer who had asked me pointedly, during a parent-teacher conference, when I would be teaching Shakespeare. Autumn's father was a large man with a brassy cheerfulness. Once I'd run into him just outside the school, and he'd said to me, "I can't believe we haven't transferred her yet, you know?"
"That book?"
said Autumn. I nodded.
"I have that book in my bag."
"Can you take it out?"
I turned to Ethan. "Do you have this book?"
"It's at my mom's, and I spent last night at my dad's."
Ethan was supposed to receive two copies of each book.
"I never got that book," said Amy.
"You did," Luca P. said. "It was in the box at the beginning of the year."
"Oh," said Amy. "I don't know where that is."
"I didn't get that book," said Philip. "I never got the box, remember?"
I said, "I left the book for you in the office." He snapped his fingers.
"I have to pick it up."
Gabriella, Caleb, and Aria had placed their books on their desks and assumed vague, irritated expressions.
"The book is in my bag," said Hazel, "but I don't know where my bag is. I think I left it in the community gathering space."
The community gathering space was in a church, which, like the gym, was being used for classes. My classes had been held there earlier in the year, and sometimes in the rig room, surrounded by rubber and ropes, I longed for the spacious, dark chapel.
"Can I go get it?"
Hazel said.
"I don't think so."
I looked at the clock. "We have 15 minutes left. It's well past time to begin." Relief came into the room,
cool and refreshing. Can you please all remember to bring this book next time? Franz Kafka was born in Prague, in what was then Bohemia. I looked around, but happily no one seemed eager to know more about Bohemia. Olivia, I said, can we please talk? Olivia glanced at me and began to pick things up and put them down, moving slowly and without purpose. She lifted a yellow cardigan from the back of her chair, considered it, replaced it, put Kafka in her backpack, and took out a floppy planner, opened it, closed it. Olivia's family had moved to the city from Montreal a few years ago, but her parents were finalizing their divorce, and her father was planning a return to Canada, alone. The grade dean sent an email every few months reminding us that this was all a strain on Olivia. Her father spoke to me bashfully, as though I were a doctor and he was confessing that he still smoked. He spent most of the parent-teacher conference assuring me that he and Olivia's mother remained very close. Her mother, in a separate conference, appeared on my screen huddled in soft-looking shawls. She told me Olivia wasn't doing any work. "Do you know," she said with wonder and some panic, "I don't think she's read a single book." Speaking to a parent could be like soothing an anxious pet. I made my voice low and said, "I'm sure we'll be able to get her on track." "I hope so." Her expression became faintly accusing. "She was a diligent student before all this." When Olivia was very young, there'd been an accident, and she had hurt one of her eyes. In the version of the story Jeremy told me, she and her older sister were playing with sticks. But Daria said she'd tripped in the woods and fallen on a stone. Whatever the cause, her eye changed color from blue to brown, and she couldn't completely see out of it. She parted her hair on the side, and during class it fell in front of her face. Thick and dark, it shielded her, protectively, like a bird's wing. It took me a few months to realize that it was her good eye she kept covered. All she saw during class was the blurry landscape I navigated when I wasn't wearing my contacts. Probably not even that. Nonetheless, if the conversation became broad, detached from the book, she participated. Her work was unbelievably late, but not plagiarized. "I completely forgot to change the phrasing of that," said Sebastian, explaining his transcription of a lit notes entry. I hadn't worried about her before the unhappy ending class. I came to regret that class. It was similar to when I'd asked sixth graders to explain away an imagined crime for an Animal Farm assignment, and three wrote about burning down the school. I'd emailed the pieces to the grade dean and the school psychologist, and for the rest of the year, every time one of them even alluded to fire, I had to write more emails. After that, when I gave the Animal Farm assignment, I told students, "Little things only, no violence." As if to punish me, they started writing nearly identical pieces about why they'd taken the last slice of pizza. I often found myself reading, "Surely you've heard of the dangers of sodium, comrades." The unhappy ending class started well. I drew hills on the rolling whiteboard to illustrate character arcs. Everyone seemed pleased with the hills, and I enjoyed being up at the board, making diagrams, feeling, for a moment, like a real teacher. The conversation became wide-ranging. Amy spoke about how artificial endings were in stories. "But in life," Caleb said, "things really do end." Gabriella mentioned climate change, the end of the seasons as we know them. "Maybe the end of humanity," Ethan said. Aria, who had seemed to be dozing for the first part of the class, looked at me and said, "Endings are just as artificial in life. Our self-absorbed point of view keeps us from seeing..." She brushed her hand through the air. "The ongoingness." Caleb straightened himself and said that not everything was ongoing, and it was kind of hard, harsh, to criticize people for being upset about loss. His expression was odd, vulnerable and pleased with himself. Arya's face had flushed in an alarming way, and I stepped in. Different moments pull for different responses. No one is suggesting anyone should react to anything in any particular way. There aren't rules. There are rules for behavior, not for feelings. I assume everyone knows that, right? This plunged the class into apathy, but they quickly started up again, moving in an entirely personal direction. They spoke about things that had gone badly for them, what one of them called their sufferings and miseries. Picking up on Caleb's idea, they spoke about loss, pets, friendships, the effects of COVID. "That sounds very hard," I said, a version of which I used several times. There was a girl in the class whose father had died when she was in elementary school. She'd been silent, and I started to notice this and wonder about it. And I was wondering about it when Olivia said, "In certain circumstances, you could understand why a person would want to end things." The class continued without pause. I thought, "Oh, that's fine. I don't have to do anything about that." But this thought often preceded the belief that I did have to act. When I read the Burn Down the School stories, I had the same thought. And earlier in the year, when I'd asked students to come to class with book recommendations and someone suggested a memoir by a Nazi, or rather a former Nazi, it's really cool to have a window into that way of thinking. I thought, they get it. I don't have to follow up. By the end of the unhappy ending day, I'd emailed the grade dean and the school psychologist. Olivia was now before me, gripping her phone. I thought of Jane holding her feathery soft dragon toy at the dentist. How soon Jane, too, would be clinging to a slippery bit of metal and glass. But the dragon was probably coated in flame retardants and other chemicals, toxins even now sinking into her skin. I saw Jane's cells, lacy and weak. Olivia said, "So?" I looked at her. "Yes. Just who I wanted to speak to." It was such a poor beginning that she gave me a look approaching compassion. "The other day, when we were talking about endings, you mentioned someone taking his, her, or their own life." I was trying to use only the phrases the school psychologist had given me, which was like hopping on a few mossy rocks to cross a stream. "I wondered how you were thinking about it." She said, "If things are bad enough and are going to stay bad, you can see how a person would head that way." I remembered a class I'd taken in college called Death. "You were thinking philosophically?" "Like Okonkwo." "You were thinking about things fall apart?" So she had read the book, or was able to seem like a person who'd read the book. I wished her mother were with us. She didn't reply. "You were thinking about the end of that novel?" She had receded into a dream, and her desire not to be in the conversation was something I could feel. Maybe I was feeling my reluctance to press her. I didn't think she was suicidal, but I wasn't completely sure. My great-grandfather had killed himself. "Stepped into a well," my father said, as though this were a distinction. And 5 years ago, my cousin had killed himself. At the school, a child had died by suicide the year I started. These deaths were like a cold pond in the back of my mind. Like most of my students, Olivia could appear older or younger than she was, depending on the day, the hour. Now she seemed tired. She was leaning into the desk, and I could imagine her curling up underneath it and falling asleep, as Jane had done once while we were finishing dinner. I said, "When someone mentions suicide," she looked, for a moment, exquisitely bored. "I'm fine." "If you aren't, there are people to talk to. Me or someone else? I can help you find someone else.
I try not to just pass the students off, said a math teacher in a meeting about traumatized children.
But, a health teacher jumped in, sometimes you aren't the best person for the job.
I'm really fine.
She tucked her hair behind an ear so I could see both of her eyes. They watched me, patiently.
How, I thought, do I wrap this up?
I said, I hope you like Kafka.
She smiled, lips closed, and left.
I put my books away with the dispiriting thought that Gregor's death, not entirely not suicide, would allow us to revisit this territory. I wrote to the grade dean and the school psychologist. I couldn't interpret the conversation, so I tried to remember Olivia's exact words. My ears were sore from the straps of my mask, and my desire for fresh air was a thirst. But I couldn't do anything about it because there was a department meeting. I walked down a flight of stairs and into a room used mostly for history classes, with views of the park, the river, the buildings across the river in Brooklyn. From the upper floors of the school, it all looked pretty and tranquil, like an illustration of a city. The room had a projector, and Glenn from Tech was coming to demonstrate a new system for submitting the little essays we wrote about students to explain their grades. The essays, called narratives, had until this point been emailed to the administration in single documents. Going forward, we would upload them, student by student, to the platform we already used for attendance, and each one would have a word limit. I checked my texts. Marion had sent a picture of Lewis eating a croissant and told me Jane was now eager to rinse her mouth with salt water.
She doesn't want the dentist to be mad at you, she wrote with a laughing emoji.
Jeremy walked in and sat at the center of the U-shaped arrangement of desks. He took out pink and yellow flyers, elective lists.
Do we know the word limit? Asked Charlie.
He had a PhD and was distantly related to an American president. I couldn't remember which one. His movements were languid, and his conversational style was to oppose whatever anyone else was saying. Sometimes he would pretend he wasn't opposing someone, only to turn on the person definitively.
I know this isn't what you meant, he would say, and then explain why the position, just what the other person meant, was fundamentally wrong and extremely stupid.
Jeremy said,
Glenn says it's not useful to think in terms of word limits because it's a space issue. It depends on if you're using long or short words.
There is, in fact, an average?
This is really happening this year?
For years, people have said narratives are too long.
Jane had once said, I wish she was my mother, about a folk singer at a street fair. This was my feeling about Jeremy. I wished he were my father. He was in his 60s, and his face was made of ridges and concavities, like the rough stones Lewis collected. He was skeptical of the students, the school, the idea of education.
What are we even doing here? He said the year I started.
I knew that his informality, his quiet voice, his somewhat frayed clothing were carefully planned, part of an effect he cultivated. And I found this effort touching. He was so likable.
Who has said that? Said Agnes, or Miss Marsh, the deeply missed teacher of my sixth graders.
In these meetings, you've never heard that?
I've never been told that.
Maybe your narratives aren't too long.
Jeremy sighed, and it was clear a less understanding person would be throwing things, firing someone, or dying of a stroke. And Jeremy had an arrhythmia, and had twice suffered. He called them events. Both times he'd fully recovered.
Who makes the decision about the word limit?
The platform.
Also, we had to change our passwords. The room fell into silence.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?